Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic Books podcast. I'm Francesca Peacock, and this week I'm speaking to Amanda Craig. Amanda's latest novel, The Golden Rule, was published last year and was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction.
Hi, Amanda. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's so brilliant to talk to you.
You too.
So we're here to discuss, I think it's your 9th novel, but do correct me if I'm wrong, The Golden Rule, which is a story about two women who, after meeting on a train, agree to swap murders. Hannah and Ginny agree to murder each other's husbands, who they are both in the process of trying to divorce. So obviously the premise of meeting a stranger on the train and then agreeing to swap murders with them is one that comes from Patricia Highsmith's Strangers on a Train. What drew you to that story initially?
Well, what drew me to it, in a way, it really grew out of my ninth novel, it depends whether you count a novella as a novel or not, called The Lie of the Land, which was also about marital breakdown. And there was a lot of research that I did, talking to people, particularly actually very close friends who were in the throes of divorce. And some of the stuff they told me was so dark that I couldn't use it in The Lie of the Land. So I thought, well, I want to use it in another novel. And something that had really struck me talking to these close friends in the throes of their dreadful divorce was how one after another, they all said it would be so much easier to be a widow than to go through divorce. With one of them, I was so angry that I said, well, why don't you kill him then? You know, I was just beside myself with rage at the kind of things that she was telling me. And as soon as I said this, of course, not seriously, I thought, well, why don't more women kill their ex-husbands? It's, you know, it's an obvious way out. You instead of having the horror of divorce and the expense of divorce, you know, if you could get away with it, you would win. And then from that, immediately, I don't always get these ideas instantly, but it was a sort of cascade. I thought, well, what if two divorced women were to meet each other and agreed to swap murders like the Patricia Highsmith? So then, of course, I thought of trains. And because I spend half my life in Devon, I thought of the train that I'm most familiar with and the journey, which is the Paddington to Penzance train, and what would happen if two women were to meet on this train journey, which I know very, very well. And from that grew the idea that one of them, the heroine, would be poor and the other one would be rich, and that it would be a handle on the way, as a way of describing this gulf between the rich and poor, which has been growing throughout my lifetime and which you see very painfully both in London and particularly, and there's been a lot of publicity about this, in Cornwall, which is full of second homes that often are barely lived in by wealthy Londoners, and very poor people, the indigenous Cornish, who can't afford to live there anymore. So it was one of those kind of gifts that began more or less to write itself as soon as I'd had this idea. And I was quite surprised by how passionate, in a way, I felt about this. But in case it sounds like I'm the world's biggest hypocrite, because I too have a second home, not in Cornwall, but in Devon, not on the coast, but in a very kind of rural, remote place, which is not kind of desirable in the way that Cornish, you know, towns are, but I still have enough of a sense of what that can be like. But I also know what it's like to be very poor, because I myself spent my 20s really kind of very hard up. I was on benefits for some of it. I was constantly worried about paying, you know, the rent, paying for food. So I do know what it feels like to be in that situation. And I'd always wanted to write about it, but I'd never found, as it were, a vehicle for doing this. So in some ways, although, you know, Hannah in my book is not me at all, this is quite autobiographical. It has its roots in autobiography. I should hasten to say that I myself am not divorced. I'm in a very happy marriage, not abusive, but I do know what an abusive relationship is like from a long time ago. And I do, of course, know what some of my girlfriends went through. And, you know, it's very shocking when you hear this stuff and you realise that people, particularly men that you've liked, that you thought were decent people, have another very unpleasant dark side to them. So all of that was sort of milling around. And of course, when you write about Cornwall, it's inevitable that you also have, you know, all the other literature that's set there, particularly Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, which plays some sort of role in the plot in this one as well.
Yeah, it definitely does. I think a lot of books crop up throughout it, but we could come back to talk about that a bit later. So you also mention in the afterword to your book that it's not just Patricia Highsmith that influenced it, but there's also a degree of like Cornish mythology as well as classical mythology. And there is, I don't want to say Gothic because I think that's wrong, but there's some sense that the things in the book are, there's some hidden kind of like deep-seated, the way the caves, so Maisie, who is Hannah's daughter, gets lured into a cave and then Hannah has to rescue her at one point. How did you feel that those, like both classical and ancient mythologies, were influencing your writing as well?
Well, in a way, this is a novel about the love of literature. You know, it's a book about books, and I think it's also a novel about misreading books as much as it's one about reading. I think a great many people can tend to do this. You know, if they love books, if they've been kind of marked by them, if they've perhaps been changed by them, and I do think that if you are a passionate reader, you are often in great danger of doing that. And there are a lot of classical novels that warn about this. I mean, perhaps most famously, Madame Bovary. Jane Austen herself and my heroine is very, very affected or afflicted by Jane Austen, does it in Northanger Abbey. It's a classic kind of trope. So, you know, this is a serious novel. It's also very playful with the idea of a novel or being trapped in a novel. Or some kind of story, as you find out right at the end. I did have a lot of fun with this, and I hope not too fun, too much fun. It's always a danger as a writer if you have more fun than the reader. So
I hope the reader has a lot of fun as well, I would say.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. But yes, and another element of that, of course, is computer gaming, which I got very interested in. I'm not a gamer myself. It gives me far too much vertigo, for one thing. But I do think that some of the things that the better kind of computer game designers are doing is absolutely fascinating if you're interested in plot and narrative. And, you know, that's still, that is something that I do, you know, one of the debates in The Golden Rule is about whether computer games can be art. And I think at the high end, you know, much like film, it is an art, and very, very fascinating what it's doing. And this idea that, unlike a novel, say, it's not a linear narrative, that, you know, you can have people making choices that lead in one direction, and then you can go back and start again and go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And their point in The Golden Rule, where I hope readers don't realise this till the end, you know, Hannah does something, but then kind of goes back and undoes it. And that was fun to think of as well, particularly with regards to murder.
Yes. There's one moment where they're discussing, I think it's at a dinner party, where people are discussing the differences between books and video games, and somebody says that books only have one plot, you can't redo it and redo it again. Have you ever read Paul Auster's 4321?
Yeah, I didn't like it.
I hated it too.
It was a great idea. Yes. I mean, there are other books that do this. I mean, there's John Fowle's French Lieutenant's Woman, which does this. Ian McEwan does this in a novel called Sweet Tooth. You know, right at the end, you suddenly realise that what you think you've been reading isn't what you've been reading. I mean, it can be a bit tricksy and it can be jolly irritating for a reader. You know, it's a high risk thing to do, but you know, I hope enough people have enjoyed it.
Yeah,
I think in this case,
definitely. Yeah. So we talked a bit about how the issue of deprivation in Cornwall affects quite a large part of the novel, because Hannah grows up in a town in Cornwall that isn't a big tourist town, and then goes to Durham to read English, where she meets Jake. And Jake is from a very different background to her. And when they marry after Hannah becomes pregnant, Hannah's continually aware of the difference between her own family and Jake's family. So there's a difference between Cornwall and London and the type of families that would happily go down to Cornwall for summer holidays and things like that. But there's also the specter of Brexit. So I think the novel's set a couple of summers after Brexit, but the conversation is still very, very much there. What was it like writing a Brexit novel then? I mean, it's a really difficult thing to do.
Well, The Lie of the Land was perhaps in a way much more a Brexit novel, because that was written pretty much as Brexit was happening. And we were, you know, very aware, because of where we live in Devon, of this huge gulf between the city and the country and all these people. I mean, we'd never met people who had, you know, wanted to vote Brexit until we came to live down here. So the post-Brexit novel, in a way, is kind of sadder and angrier. You know, I don't want to lecture people about politics. I think that's a terrible bore in a book, but I did want to dramatize it, because certainly if you write contemporary fiction, these things are incredibly interesting to explore. And Hannah, of course, is a more educated, and you know, Hannah's become middle class, but the family she's from are, you know, fairly poor, but you know, they're still employed. Cornish working class, and of course they are Brexiteers, they voted for it. And if you know why you know, parts of the country, I mean, Cornwall was an obvious choice, because it voted overwhelmingly for Brexit, sort of more than almost any other county. And if you know people there and listen to their reasons, even if you think they're mistaken, you can kind of see why they thought this was a solution. You know, there's a lot to do with fishing, almost, you know, even though fishing is a tiny part of their economy, almost everybody is connected to it. And, you know, that plus not having a home, plus not, you know, feeling that you can't get to see a doctor, you can't get your children into schools, all of which is blamed on immigrants. You know, these are really interesting things to examine in a novel about contemporary life. And to make that entertaining, of course, and not a lecture, is terrifically hard work, but it's also fun. You know, I've spoken up a lot about my, you know, fury at the way that historical fiction remains the dominant literary form in this country. I think we are really kind of handicapped, as it were, by a form of nostalgia. It's very, very difficult to write contemporary fiction. As far as I know, myself and Ali Smith are the only ones who are writing State of the Nation novels. I mean, she's much more of a modernist. I'm more traditional, and I tell a story and have a plot. But it is hard to capture what is going on in the present. You know, it's a very kind of high risk thing to be doing, but that's also the fun bit.
Yeah, it's really necessary as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I mean, part of my motivation for writing this kind of fiction is that, you know, I want to be seen perhaps one day, if not now, as you know, the Trollope or the Dickens of our time, you know, that people will be able to go back in 100 years' time and read fiction and think, this is what it was like then. They won't be reading newspapers or looking at old TV reels. That's kind of boring, but they may be reading fiction, I hope.
Yeah, it's really, I think you are right to say we probably do actually lack a lot of our fiction is very much engaged with nostalgia, even the things that do very well and are very important. So if you're building off contemporary things as well, you talked about how some of the abuse and the violence that's present in the novel came out of interviews where you interviewed, I don't know, were they friends or acquaintances? How was it using real people's experience that are so physical and intimate, as well as being almost universal in the sense? How is it like tying those two things together?
Well, it was horrible to write about. I mean, you know, I do describe in all my novels, which very often feature things like murder for one reason or another, I do go into violence. And you always have to relive both your own experience of it and, think very, very hard. You know, it's almost like method acting, you know, how you get into that state of mind. But I'm afraid it is a horrifyingly common experience for women. I would actually say that most of the women I know who are all kind of, you know, educated, professional, middle class, now mostly middle-aged women have experienced it. And it's certainly my impression that women now are actually more oppressed than they were when I was growing up, for a variety of reasons, you know, whether it's pornography on the internet or trolling or just abuse. You know, it's really rife. I think that men who used to be brought up perhaps to respect women and treat them with, you know, gentleness, that's become more and more rare. I'm writing another novel not about abuse, but, you know, about someone much, much younger who's 25, and just talking to the 25-year-olds that I know, I've been appalled by what they're going through. It's really not fun being young, is it? I mean, we laugh, but, you know, it is horrifying. I feel very sad and concerned about that. You know, it's, and also one of the things that is most wonderful for me as a writer is I know, you know, when I get things right, because I get so much mail from people who say that my books have helped them, that they've, you know, that they feel as if I'm describing their own life, that they've given them more courage, you know, all the things that you hope when you're writing. Definitely. So that is nice.
I think what you say about kind of generational differences, I think it's really, really true. I think we definitely have a bit of a problem in feminism not particularly maybe going in the right direction.
Yeah, no, it's grim. I mean, you know, the one thing is, I think people, women now do tend to be perhaps a bit more open about stuff than they were, but that too has, you know, can have its downsides. That, it's very easy to feel a sort of despair about everything, and I think despair should be resisted. But I do think people are still being sold all sorts of lies about the way we live now.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really, really interesting to think about. And I think there's a moment in the novel where it becomes quite clear is when Jake has become quite physically violent towards Hannah, and his mother steps in and she is so horrified by what she's managed to raise, and in a sense, some real horror there as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not the mother's fault you know, that's the thing. I think that's not, again, you know, people just don't realise what's been happening with their sons or their, you know, their young men. I mean, the every single specific, you know, act of violence that Jake commits is a real life thing that was you know, described to me. Those have all happened, you know, to people I know, which is ghastly to think about. And, you know, it's small potatoes compared with some of the other stuff too. But, you know, I don't want it to be so dark. You know, I think if you have a novel which is just about domestic abuse, people get really turned off. I mean, this is an adventure story. It's a love story. It's a mystery. You know, part of it is based on things like Beauty and the Beast, which is a fairy story I really love. So, you know, there is someone who counterbalances Jake, because the other thing I don't like are these stories in which all men are evil and wicked and violent and so on. And there is someone who's totally different from that in this story.
Yeah. I'm really sorry to take it away from that moment of hope. I wanted to ask about Hannah's experience at the advertising agency, where there's almost like continual groping and everything. You said that it's not an autobiographical novel, but that was one element in which autobiography also played a part.
Yes. Yes. No, I mean, I, you know, a million years ago, I'm such a dinosaur now. I did work for an advertising agency, very posh one. And it was one of the worst years of my life. I mean, not just because of that, I just loathed the whole industry. But I did then also talk to a number of young women who are currently working in advertising agencies. And lo and behold, it doesn't really seem to have changed. You know, they may now have human resources departments who are supposed to put a stop to this, but the fear and the consequences if you do that are quite dreadful. You know, that there are good advertising agencies as well, but I think I would be quite alarmed if a young woman I know went into one.
Yeah.
Even now. You know, I don't think that. I think there's something that's sort of inherently very corrupting about a lot of them. And this idea that everything is for sale, everything is just about marketing and branding. I mean, that always bleeds over into how you treat other people.
It's a really fascinating idea because, yeah, it kind of alters how you feel about the end of the book, I suppose, in a way. Which is really fascinating. So we've already mentioned a bit how important stories are and books are to the book. So Hannah is a massive reader and grew up reading because of a bookshop very close to her in Cornwall, and she identifies with herself perhaps misreading Jane Austen, looking for a kind of Austen-like hero. So maybe I just wanted to ask if you thought that she reads her way out of that, or real life kind of disabuses her of that kind of
I don't think she necessarily reads her way out of that. I mean, things happen and she comes to understand things about her life. I mean, one of the things that was very interesting to me talking to these friends who had these disaster marriages, I mean, I'm a sort of horrible friend to them, I'm sure, because I would get so angry. And I said, but couldn't you see that he was really bad news? Couldn't you see that this was not going to turn out well? And one after another, they all said, oh, but I thought he was like Mr. Rochester or Heathcliff. Yeah. At this point, you sort of have your head in your hands thinking, but don't you see those people are, you know, murderers and bullies and thugs? You know, they're the last kind of man. But, you know, I think perhaps women particularly are very prone to misreading signals. You know, that things that are put in as warnings to them, you know, are somehow made romantic. And of course, the Gothic genre is particularly prone to doing that, you know, culminating, of course, in Count Dracula. But, you know, you do need to read wisely and correctly. You know, these things are not just put you know, when someone tells lies and is a brute and deceives you, these things are not there for kind of decoration. They are intrinsic to the man. I mean, Rochester is appalling, you know, even when he's been blinded and humiliated, you know, a sensible woman wouldn't touch him with a barge pole. But there you are, then there'd be no story. So, you know, I wanted to do a different kind of hero. And I'm, you know, I was very happy writing Stan as he is, because it seemed to me that perhaps, well, certainly I hadn't come across someone who was quite like him, you know, who is very unprepossessing when you first see him, and he's drunk as well. But, you know, he is a truly good and brave and gentle and brilliant man, you know, and that was great fun to imagine. It was also fun to go into his professional life a little bit.
Which is really fascinating, the way that video games and books kind of rub up against each other, which I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, very often, I mean, particularly if you're a parent of a teenage boy, reading and gaming are set in opposition, and parents worry terribly that their children are being sucked into this fantasy world, that they're not doing their work, they're not doing proper reading. And I've got a lot of sympathy with that. I've been there myself. But I do think that by and large, you know, if you have done the groundwork and encouraged them to read and read with them, and you talk about books and have them on your shelves, they are already quite inoculated against the real addictive properties of gaming. And actually, by and large, they tend to be particularly intelligent kids that are very interested in a lot of things. And video games themselves are at this, you know, really fascinating point in their development, where, as I think Stan says, you know, that they are the ones who are keeping lots of classical orchestras going. They're using not just these incredible designers and technicians, but, you know, often they're even employing philosophers. You know, there's a lot of philosophical content in some of these games, and the best ones are quite mind-bending. So I think they're very exciting. you know, I've been very interested to learn that he was at George R. R. Martin has worked with one of the biggest Japanese gaming companies to produce a new game. Apparently is rather wonderful. So, you know, it's great. Anything that keeps art financially viable, you know, does get my vote, even if I'm never going to play that particular game.
Yeah, definitely. To move on to a slightly different subject, the last, I'm not quite sure how many of your novels have had minor characters that then reappear as major characters, and major characters that then become minor characters in the next ones. But there's something to do with like the creating the universe in a game that's kind of similar to, I don't want to impose that on you, but is there something there as well, like creating a
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's I got the idea from Victorian novelists that I adore, like Trollope, who does the same thing, and Balzac, who's a great influence on me. But yes, it is part of creating this kind of parallel universe. There is an element which is like playing a game, slightly against yourself. And every now and again, unfortunately, I always hope nobody will notice, you know, every now and again, I do make an error that I can't go back. I have to think of a way out. Say, for instance, with the golden rule, Jake has this line at the end, which is a real line from a real person, who says, "I'm a natural blonde with a title. I'm not going to stay single for long." And I thought, oh my God, how has he got this title? You know, he's the wrong branch of the family. I've now worked out how it can do, but you'll see some of the paperbacks in the reprints have changed. I'm a natural blonde with a title to "I'm a natural blonde with a castle," because it fitted the same number of letters. I mean, you can tie yourself in the most terrible knots with this sort of thing. But yes, I've sorted out that particular wrinkle. It was very obvious once I really put my mind to it. But you know, it is like playing this giant game of cat's cradle with each book. You know, who are you going to bring back? What's going to have happened to them? Particularly because the events of each novel, I mean, you don't need to read all the novels to you know, enjoy them. They each stand on their own. But the more you read of my backlist, the more you'll see, you know, what I'm doing with it. You know, it is a challenge to myself. What will have happened to the characters? Because I've now been published for 32 years. So this fictional universe has been growing for some time.
So brilliant, though. It's really exciting. If you've written something that's kind of a post-Brexity novel and you've got these reoccurring characters and you're always engaging with the state of the nation, is there a chance that you'll write a COVID novel, do you think?
A COVID novel? Well, interesting you should ask. I began the novel that I've just finished, which is called The Three Graces, in the middle of the pandemic. And I thought I didn't want to write about what people were going through because it was sort of too awful and depressing. But I did have a very strong feeling. I mean, this is the other thing that's, you know, you become slightly kind of, people think I'm psychic because I often kind of foretell things that then happen. It's nothing to do with being psychic. It's just thinking what's logical. I did have a very strong feeling that in 2 years' time, i.e. I was writing in the year 2020, there would be a vaccine. We would have come out of this. And indeed, that is now happening. So this novel is very much set in 2022. And it's got an oligarch in it who's hiding from Putin. What, of course, I didn't foretell was the whole Ukrainian war. And what, you know, what that's doing to all these Ukrainians with their billions being frozen. So there are big chunks of it that I'm rewriting right now to try and fit with, you know, what's happening in the outside world. You know, that's quite a challenge, but it's good fun.
That's really
exciting. I hope it'll still be plausible.
I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.